Next case on the call is State versus Britt. Proceed, thank you.
Good morning and Happy New Year, Your Honors. I'm Mike Wilson. I represent the appellant in this matter, Timothy Britt. May it please the court, counsel for the government. This is the second time I've been before this court on this case. This court may know that this case was remanded for a new trial based on improperly admitted hearsay. And based on my having been present for the entire trial, I did not have to re-raise that issue. I did raise a different assignment of error this time around, however. It has to do with the photographic exhibits that were admitted at this trial. And in thinking about how I wanted to present this oral argument today, I considered actually using some of the technology in the Supreme Court courtroom that is very rarely used from my experience, but I thought instead of showing the photographs and doing all that, I thought that would be kind of a waste of the court's time. You, obviously, Your Honors, have the photographs, you have the record, you can look at the photographs, compare them yourselves, and there are a couple questions that I'm hoping Your Honors will keep in mind as you review those. And it really is centering on the language in the most, I think, relevant case law on this topic. And the state and I don't disagree on the case law. There's a case, Dubray, that really is the most recent on-point case here. And one of the things it points out is that so long as there's a proper foundation, we're not arguing there was not a proper foundation, as long as the photographs, they illustrate or make clear a controverted issue. And that could be something like identification, nature and extent of the wounds to a body, establishing malice or intent. Those are the sorts of issues that Dubray says are important in determining whether photographs should go beyond the pale in terms of more prejudicial than probative. So,
what other purposes are considered permissible for photographs in a context like this?
Presenting a coherent picture of the crime is mentioned in Dubray as well. That's also language, and I was going to address that as well. I think my point is with that language, this is a felony murder case. It was uncontroverted that people were shot in this home, that these bodies were there, that the victims were who the state said they were, that and that the intent was derived from an intent to rob. So this is a case of transferred intent. There's really no issue of malice or intent in this case. Because it's, again, charged solely as felony murder. So while I agree that the state does have the opportunity to present a coherent picture and that they can generally choose their evidence in doing so, the picture of the crimes at issue here, particularly given the fact that they're charged as felony murder and that was the only theory the state was proceeding on, the picture would not have been any less coherent without these redundant, gruesome photographs.
Would the photographs aid the fact finder in determining whether or not there was more than one shooter?
That's a good question, Your Honor, because that is relevant here. And because, we obviously, Mr. Britt's defense is he's not in this house, that these are other folks acting.
There was some shooting.
Correct.
But I wasn't in the home.
Right. And so the next question then, I think what you're saying is, could this, to these photographs, these extra photographs, what we're saying are redundant or extra or unnecessary photographs.
During the course of the incident, did these photographs tend to establish or tend to prove there was more than one shooter? The location of the bodies, and is it on two floors?
There's one floor, main floor was where the shooting allegedly occurred.
Right. And one of the victims came upstairs and...
Well, he heard the walking around, right. And he heard multiple people walking around upstairs. So, right. You know, there's... The state's theory, obviously, is that there are two people, my client and a co-defendant. Mr. Britt's theory is that, you know, we don't know how many people it was, but it wasn't Mr. Britt. So, I mean, I don't know how in controversy the number of shooters was or the number of attempted, you know, robbery folks, the people committing a robbery. I can't say that for sure, but I do know that when you look at these photographs, the picture of this crime is no less coherent without the ones that were challenging. The photographs in question, you know, we're talking about a matter of a few degrees sometimes of turning the camera to get a different, I guess the state would say, a different angle. Sometimes reversing the direction in which the photographs are taken, but really not illuminating anything, any new evidence, really, with respect to the photos that we're specifically challenging. The brief does try to have, you know, we cite the record, I try to use the comparison, compare Exhibit 120, you know, with Exhibits 124. I tried to do that to give the court a guide to what I was thinking.
But those would be different angles with respect to one victim, that kind of thing?
That kind of thing,
right,
yes.
So would you say they were cumulative?
I'd say that, Your Honor. I'd say they're cumulative, and, you know, if it's a cumulative photo of a shell casing on the ground, that's not a big deal. But when it's a cumulative photo of a dead 16-year-old, that's unnecessary. And it does nothing more than prejudice the jury.
Do you have to show prejudice?
I believe we do. It's an abuse of discretion standard. And, you know, if we can show that the judge abused her discretion, then the next question is, did this prejudice Mr. Britt? In my brief, I sort of returned to the same analysis this court did in the first appeal, which was the evidence was pretty closely balanced here. There wasn't forensic evidence. There wasn't, you know, of course there was forensic evidence, but there wasn't great forensic evidence tying my client.
No DNA of your client.
Exactly. Right.
No fingerprints of your client in the home.
Correct, Your Honor. And no statements by my client either.
Eyewitnesses.
All eyewitness. All four of the eyewitnesses were had vested interests in this case. They were all granted some form of immunity, that sort of thing.
So, did that come out at trial?
Yes,
it did. Their arrangements or deals they were given?
Correct, Your Honor. It did. If there are any other questions, Your Honors, I'll take them. But with that, I'd...
Do you make a distinction between among the photographs at the scene as compared to the autopsy?
Again, I think it depends on the ones that we challenge, Your Honor. I don't make much of a distinction there. I think autopsy photographs can be equally disturbing and graphic and ultimately engender a sense of retribution in a jury that shouldn't be there at that point, you know, that shouldn't be there in a murder trial. And, you know, Your Honors, this just seems to be a common practice among district courts and the state courts and I'm saying this based on published case law. There are just several cases that where I've represented the appellant and other cases, you know, in the past decade or so that have raised this over and over because we're seeing it over and over. So, you know, I'm hopeful that this case presents this court an opportunity to expand on some of the case law that we see in DeBray.
Expand or limit?
Well, I think clarify. Perhaps.
What needs clarification or expansion, in your opinion?
Well, in DeBray, the statement that, you know, this evidence is relevant for purposes of in a homicide prosecution, a court may admit into evidence photographs of a victim for identification to show condition of the body, nature, extent of the wounds, injuries to that body, establishing malice or intent. Well, a homicide prosecution includes a felony murder prosecution. And in a felony murder prosecution, malice and intent are almost, they're essentially irrelevant, other than proving intent of the predicate felony. And then, so, you know, that's one situation here where we don't have, there was no argument, there was no controverted issue as to malice or intent. So there are, that portion of it, I think, could be expanded on. There is nuance to that, especially given the different types of homicide cases. So that's where I'm getting.
Could the admission, if this were wrongful, be harmless error?
We're arguing it's not. However, you know, that's the court could find that. We argue it's not primarily because of the closely balanced nature of this evidence and, again, the overly graphic nature of the photos. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Melissa Vincent and I represent the Appalachian State of Nebraska. There are two issues on appeal. One was raised by Britt's counsel and the other by Britt acting pro se. I intend to address the former, but will submit the latter on the brief. Britt claims the district court erred by admitting certain photos into evidence because they were duplicative and or unfairly prejudicial. We disagree. Photos at issue here can be placed into essentially four categories. The first category includes exhibits 113, 118, and 119, which depict the hallway where Jose was murdered. Britt claims those photos were duplicative. However, each of those photos was taken from a different angle and was part of a much larger group of photos that was intended to present a coherent picture of the crime scene, as well as to orient the jury as to where the victims were and other items of evidence were located. All of those photos were properly admitted. The second group consists of exhibits 124 and 132, which Britt claims were duplicative of exhibit 120. However, both photos were taken from an entirely different perspective and each focused on different items of evidence. One showed the location where Miguel Jr. was shot, while the other showed two shell casings that were found just inside the door. All three of those photos were offered for different purposes. The third group consists of exhibits 140, 141, 144, and 145, which are additional photos of Jose. Britt claims these photos were both duplicative and unfairly prejudicial. However, unlike the previous photos, which depicted the location of Jose's body, these photos focused on his injuries and the condition of his body, which, as this court has repeatedly recognized, are valid purposes.
How do those purposes relate in a felony murder case to the point being raised by your opposing counsel?
Because I think it's still a murder. I mean, true, you can substitute the underlying intent for the felony, for example, the intent to commit the robbery, but the reality is it's still a murder and you still have to show that people died. And so I guess I'm not totally sold on the reasoning. I mean, I understand where he's coming from, but I still think that it's a murder, and while not premeditated, I still think that they're relevant to show exactly what happened, or as Justice Miller-Lerman suggested, maybe to show that there were multiple shooters or how this event transpired once it started inside the house. Because I believe in this case, there were two shooters. There were victims, or there were bullet fragments from a 22 caliber and a 40 caliber that were found in both the victims. I believe Miguel Jr. had 22s, Jose had both, and I think that Mr. Avalos was shot with the 40 caliber. I may be mistaken, but I'm pretty sure as I was going over my notes yesterday that it showed that that's what happened. And of course, we have Francisco's testimony saying that he heard at least two people in the residence. And then we've got Britt being the only person with Davis before, during, and after these homicides. And of course, the other evidence from Claire.
What is your response to Mr. Wilson's suggestion that the evidence was balanced and therefore the photos were prejudicial?
I don't know what they're closely balanced with. I mean, the defendant didn't put on any evidence. And I don't agree that it's closely balanced. I don't think the state's evidence against Mr. Britt was by any means weak. We had the state presented the testimony of several witnesses, which collectively clearly implicated him in these murders. I don't really think there's any question. I thought it was strong the last time, and the last time that I was here, even though I had a much greater obstacle with that one. I did pitch the argument that there was harmless error in that case as well, notwithstanding Davis's statements, because I thought all of the circumstantial evidence showing that Britt was involved in these murders was strong enough to potentially counterbalance that. Now, the court didn't agree, and I understand why. But here, you know, we're dealing with a much different issue. We're talking about perhaps a few improperly admitted photos. I don't think that's enough to say that that tipped the scale in this case and caused the jury to convict.
Does the nature of Mr. Britt's defense being, I wasn't even there, does that factor into the harmless error analysis? Because it seems to me the theory is that, you know, the jury is prejudiced by these photos and they're going to move to take it out on someone. But if his defense is, I wasn't even at the crime scene, is there a disconnect between those two things?
Well, I'm not really sure, because absent some evidence on behalf of the defendant, I mean, it's you know, you can say, well, that's my theory. I mean, you put the state to their proof, and that's fine. But if you don't put on any evidence showing that, in fact, you weren't there, I have no evidence suggesting that Britt wasn't there. Everything the state put on showed that he was Davis's accomplice. I think that is the, you know, inexorable conclusion based on all of the evidence that was presented. And keeping in mind, of course, we've got four different witnesses who were involved at various stages of this. Two of them, only two of them knew each other. The others did not. Their testimony interlocks in very significant ways, but they all placed him, Britt, you know, going with them to Case the residence, being with Branch and Jones, them taking them to the area of 9th and Bancroft when these things take place, and then he's with him immediately after that. You know, I don't know that his defense necessarily was, well, gee, I wasn't even there. And if we're operating under felony murder, it wouldn't necessarily matter if he went with Davis and he stood as a lookout outside the residence and somebody else came in and helped with the shootings. I mean, he's still going to be implicated. It's felony murder simpliciter. If he was involved and participated in the underlying robbery, he's still on the hook for the murders. So I don't know that that necessarily makes a difference here.
In that, circumstantial evidence would make him an accomplice at a minimum.
At a minimum.
In terms of commonly accepted activity.
True. And if you accept Claire Day's testimony, because she was the one who went to pick them up after Davis called her, when they got back to Branch and Jones' residence, he didn't want to ride home from Branch. He immediately started calling Claire Day. She came to pick them up, and when Britt got in the car, which she didn't want him to do, she immediately said to him, do you have anything you're not supposed to have? He gave her the gun. It's the same gun that she later ditched in the culvert and led law enforcement to. And it was the casting of the barrel was consistent with the markings on the gun. So if you credit her testimony that she actually got that gun from Britt, I mean, clearly that implicates him in the offense and suggests that he was the person who fired the .22.
What, in your view, would be an abuse of discretion with respect to crime scene photos in a homicide case? Can you envision a circumstance where a court would abuse its discretion?
Possibly. I mean, that's a question I've asked myself several times, because I'm not aware of any cases where this objection has actually resulted in reversal of a conviction. And I was trying to think, because one of the problems I have just generally about gruesome photos is I get the general concept that you don't want to, you know, just out of general sense of decency, you don't want to inundate juries with graphic and disturbing photos of a crime scene. You know, that I get. What I don't get is this notion that if you show them a certain number of a certain type of image, that they're more likely to convict the defendant. I mean, crime scene photos show you what happened. They don't tell you who did it. That's what the other evidence is for. And so I always had a little bit of a problem. I was like, well, I'd like to think the juries are smarter than that, and they're able to sort that out.
But the notion of 403 is maybe the juries need a little help from being pulled back from prejudice and stick to the evidence.
Exactly. But to get, you know, back to that point is I was trying to think of, well, when would this ever be an appropriate or a successful objection? And the only thing I could come up with was, well, if you have maybe an excessive number of photos where the state's evidence implicating the defendant was exceptionally weak. And you might have, you know, that, I think that might come into play, but that's not this case. One, I don't think these photos were excessive. I've done a number of homicides out of Douglas County. I don't see anything unusual about the number or the nature of the photos that were offered here. But beyond that, I have plenty of evidence implicating him in these offenses.
Is it different if it's a case where the question is, the level of culpability of the defendant. We know the defendant was responsible for something, and it's where on a continuum of culpability it lies. And we're going to say, well, these photos are really graphic, and because of that, we're worried that the jury is going to say, well, we got to punish this guy as harshly as we could. Look what happened to these people. And is that different than a case here where it seems like it's kind of binary? Either he was at the scene and he was responsible, or he wasn't.
Well, I mean, in the felony murder context, it doesn't really matter because he's liable no matter what.
Right, or either he's involved or he's not, yeah.
Right, but typically if you're looking at what their role is in the murder or the offense, that's something that typically gets addressed. I mean, here it wouldn't necessarily determine his culpability, you know, I mean, unless it was a crime that actually required the defendant to have the specific intent to do something, and not here where it's robbery, but to commit a premeditated murder or some other offense where it requires that he have specific intent. But in most instances, when you're looking at when multiple people involved in a single crime, issues of culpability and how involved this person was in the offense are typically sentencing issues. Those are things that you argue in mitigation of punishment. And of course, the jury's not responsible for punishment. They're just trying to determine criminal liability. And in this case, certainly that's not, I don't think that's an issue because it's felony murder. Does that answer your question?
I'm looking to see if there are further questions from the bench.
Nope.
No.
Okay, well, we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the
district
court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think Mr. Wilson has some time. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't intend to use that entire time, but I wanted to make a couple of quick points. Based on what we just heard, I want to point out that a lot of the time when we're challenging these photos, and I think in this case you'll see this, she mentioned, you know, we've got an angle where we see the body, and we've got another angle, or the pool of blood, and we've got another angle where we see the pool of blood, and, oh, wait, but there's some shell casings over here. We want to make sure the jury sees those, too. We live in a day and age where we can, well, we could have done this years ago with a pair of scissors. We can crop photos. We don't have to necessarily have all the blood and gore in every single photo over and over and over and over again. And
did you ask that any of the photos be cropped?
I'm trying to, you know, this kind of just came to me as I was listening, so I'm trying to recall if we asked specifically for that remedy. We may not have, but I think the objection at least preserves it, and that's something that...
Haven't we recently said that it doesn't?
Oh.
If you want to redact something... You have to ask that it be redacted.
If Your Honor is clearly thinking of something very specific that I am not familiar with, so I will not argue that point with you.
You can look at State v. Thomas later.
I will do that, and I won't argue the point with you.
All right.
However, I would suggest that that is a potential solution here if this comes up, and certainly something that the court could consider. But my point is, when we have, you know, redundant photos of the gore or, you know, a dead juvenile or whatever it might be, we don't necessarily have to have them in the background of every single photo, every piece of evidence at the scene. When you've got at least one photo showing the orientation of the body or more even, it's unnecessary.
Is your argument only as to the redundancy of the photos? Because once the gore has been shown, mm-hmm. does the redundancy really cause any harm?
I think it can, Your Honor. I know that I get your point. I think that if it's like anything else, cumulative is an objection in and of itself, and it really goes to 403. If it's cumulative, it tends to prejudice the jury because it's hammering away at a point that's already been illuminated. So you know, that point in a case like this is, look how awful this is. Look how awful this is that these young men died. And it is awful.
Is there any science that indicates that, you know, the repetition of seeing violence and gore creates, I don't know, a reaction to a juror, for example? My point is, people are seeing gore and violence every day, right? Mm. In today's entertainment world. Mm-hmm. And so when they see these photos once and they see all the gore that's there,
Why is it that seeing 10 or 12 or 20 more of the same types of things, why is that making it any worse? They've already been subjected to a horrible, you know, array of photos of the crime scene.
That's good questions, Your Honor. And if there were scientific studies in any of the case law that I could find, obviously, I would cite those for you. Certainly, it's a good thought toward future cases. And as for this case in particular, I kind of fall back to the 403 rule, which is, you know, when we add unnecessary yet prejudicial evidence, the more we do it, the more prejudiced the jury can become. Hopefully that answers your question. That's the best I can do at the moment.
Well, to be clear with Judge Bishop's question, mm-hmm. it's not, is this correct that it's not that, let me say this in a vague sense, at least one photo after each victim may be suitable?
I believe so, Your Honor. Okay. Yeah.
And would that be also true with autopsy photos?
Yes, and I don't, that's right. And that's why this is couched in terms of redundancy, duplicitous, whatever word you want to use. That I'm not trying to deny the state an opportunity to present the coherent picture of the crime.
Isn't the sort of the underlying basis of our case law in this area a perception that the trial judges are in the best position to make the calls on the question that you're talking about, and it really needs to be something out of whack before an appellate court is going to intervene on a question like this? Isn't that the underlying premise of our case law?
That's an underlying premise, I mean, even of just the standard of review, I think, yeah. When you talk about an abuse of discretion.
And so what is it about this particular case? Because we see this argument made frequently. Mm-hmm. 5 is okay, but 6 is too many. Mm-hmm. Why? What's the principled basis upon which we make that call? Or are we really just substituting our view for the trial court's view?
That's excellent questions, Your Honor. And ultimately, I respect the standard of review here, which is an abuse of discretion standard. District court judges sit in the court with the exhibits and the jury, and they do have that perspective, which is a good perspective. The difference here, if I can point anyone out, well, there's a couple, and I mentioned them during the beginning, which was I did not see in the case law specific analysis of this argument in the context of felony murder and how it relates to these issues that are on which the photos are supposed to be probative. That would include malice intent. That would include, that's the big one, is malice and intent. Obviously, there are a couple others that we talked about. But even, you know, extent of the wounds and identification. In this particular case, and in a lot of felony murder cases, these issues are uncontroverted. So
did you attempt to stipulate to those issues at trial?
No, there was no attempt to stipulate to those issues at trial. Obviously, this was a robbery, was the predicate felony. And so, you know, this actually kind of takes me back to Justice Papik's point, which is, I think you said whether our defense theory sort of takes the teeth out of this argument. If he's not there, then it really wouldn't, I guess, matter how gruesome the crime scene was. Is that, and I think that's kind of where you were going with that. The fear here, again, is that in a closely balanced case, which I know the state and I disagree on that, but we feel that the evidence was closely balanced, that in a closely balanced case, the more anger and, you know, disgust you feed to the jury or engender within the jury members, the more danger there is in a closely balanced case of an unjust verdict.
With respect to the defense, mm-hmm. I wasn't there in the home. Did the defense encompass, I was uninformed about a robbery? I wasn't on the block?
So that's getting into the evidence is really where you have to get to sort of understand our defense theory. I mean, there were certain points where, for instance, there's a video of, she mentioned Tiata Clarida was sort of their star witness. Tiata Clarida says that my client's with them when they leave this home where they allegedly came after the shooting, and they, meaning Mr. Britt and Mr. Davis. And so the testimony was they went to this gas station. There's a video from the gas station introduced by the state. You can see straight through this car, through the back window, and you can't see Mr. Britt in this vehicle at all. So, you know, there, I submit that the state's evidence shows that the case is closely balanced, and that the defense theory...
But the question was, what's the scope of the defense? I didn't shoot, I never entered the home, never heard about it, wasn't in town.
The defense
what's
theory
the parameter
was,
of the defense?
The defense theory was that that Mr. Britt had no involvement, really. I mean, even at the planning stage, or even if he was there, he was nowhere near the scene when this thing took place.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think we kept you over. Appreciate
thank you,
it. Thank you. Does the state want a minute? All right. Thank you. We're excused. That's the last case on today's call. Thank you.